Welcome to Rock Harbor Church's channel on Sermon Audio. We hope this message is a blessing to you and helps you in your daily walk with our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So please, settle in and grab your Bibles. Here's Pastor Brandon with this message.
Okay, so we're picking up on the Church of Pergamum, and I'm taking my time going through each one of them because you have to know the church and what the problems were to understand how to overcome the issue of that church and get their reward. So that's why I'm spending a little more time on each church instead of just going to the reward and us missing the whole context of why that reward is given, because all of us have to overcome Pergamum. All of us have to overcome Ephesus. All of us have to overcome Thyatira, and all of us have to overcome Laodicea. So that's why you have to know these churches backwards and forwards so that you know how to get the reward. Pergamum, as I mentioned last time, the Greek word per and gamos, it's a combination of two words, which means thoroughly married. And so per would be thoroughly, and then gamos is married, so thoroughly married. And this is at the time when the church marries the state, and I talked about that and the unholy union that caused. So what we started watching, and as I took us through last week, of how Babylon entered into the church, and the practices of the Babylonian cult religion has made its way into the church and still with us today, one of which I mentioned, the Madonna Child cult, the fertility goddess cult, child of Tammuz. That made its way in. It's been in multiple religions. I talked about that. And now it's centered into the Roman Catholic Church as the Madonna and Child. And they'll argue with you that it's not what it's doing. Then I want to say, then why do you do it then? Why do you put Mary in that kind of position? And why do you put Jesus as always baby Jesus? I don't understand that. He's a man. I don't know why you still have him as a baby. Anyway, You can deal with the Catholic apologists all day long until the cows come home, but it's not going to change church history because this is when it entered, and they know it did. The other thing that entered is the concept of the bishop being or the bishop having the control over a lot of other dioceses, ending up being the pope, obviously. But the Magian high priest of the Magi was called the chief bridge builder. So he was the connector between the gap of the physical world and the spiritual world. He was the bridge builder. And that's how it was in the Babylonian cult religion. Like I mentioned on the Babylonian towers, and again, you don't want to think about it as a tower, you want to think about it as a ziggurat, that on the tower, that's where they created a portal to enter into the spiritual realm and for the spiritual realm to enter our physical realm. Now, portals can be created with drugs, hallucinogens, it could be created with witchcraft, it could be created with occultism, it can be created with necromancy. There's all kinds of various things in which portals can be created that open the pathways from our world to theirs, and people do this on a personal level, sometimes through drugs and psychedelics and stuff like that, LSD and all those kinds of other hallucinogens. That's the danger, obviously, with even drugs, is that you can tap into that world and then be what we call demonized through that. Not necessarily possessed, which can lead to possession if you're an unbeliever, but a believer who's doing drugs can be demonized because they'll tap into that world, and then that means that they have the freedom to terrorize you, and they will. They'll take full advantage of that because they're very legal. Anyway, so the term for bridge builder or a bridge keeper in Latin is Pontifex Maximus, which is given to now the Pope. That's his title, Pontifex Maximus. So he's the bridge keeper. So it's just weird. So what you'll see in the Catholicism, again, and this is hard to deny it. So this is the Dagon priest from the ancient world. And obviously, you can see on the hat, the fish head, the fish hat, the open mouth fish hat. And then you look at the Pope's hat, and it's like, dude, where'd you get that style from, man? And it's not like just Pope Francis is wearing it. They've all worn it, right? This is hundreds and hundreds of years old that they wear the fish hat with the open mouth on the top. And I don't understand even the whole point of wearing the hat, but where does this garb come from? It comes from Babylonian priests. It comes from pagan religions, as you can see. And it finds itself nowhere in the Bible at all. You can't find, like, you know, Peter or the apostles wearing crazy hats like this. This is the costume party, right? Like, what are you doing? And it's all just, it's all form and outward religion type stuff. But as you can see, it's very ancient. And there's some other pictures of the fish head of Dagon. And I think this is Pope Paul, John Paul, wearing the fish hat. And again, it's just, what are we doing here, man? What are we doing here? Well, I'll explain a little bit how this happened. The other thing that's very curious, and I shouldn't say curious, it makes sense, I guess, but I grew up Catholic, so I'd like to ask my Catholic friends, what do you think when you go to Vatican Square and there's a huge obelisk right in the middle of Vatican Square? And a lot of them don't even understand that. Well, they'll go to Washington, D.C., and they'll see the Washington Monument and not think twice about that. But they don't understand that there's a giant phallus. And it comes from Egypt. It not just comes from Egypt, it comes from all pagan religions. Whether you're dealing with totem poles or you're dealing with Asherah poles or whatever, all of them, that the pole is a representative of the phallus. It's a symbol of the fertility gods. So the reason it's in Washington, because some of our founders were Masons, and the Masonics had that symbol, and it's a giant phallus in Masons. It is what it is. Many of them were Freemasons. And so they brought a lot of that Freemasonry in. By the way, if you want to see a lot of Freemasonry, you just look at the Mormons, because the Mormons have the same symbols all through their churches. The Beehive and All Sinai, all that stuff, it's all there. If you go to like the Mormon temple in Utah and stuff, it's all there. It's totally satanic. It's totally weird. And I don't know how they deal with it. It's just very, very satanic. So you go to Vatican Square, they have a huge obelisk, which is a giant phallus. And we all know what a phallus is, right? I don't need to spell that out, right? Okay. I don't think our young people are looking at me, what's a phallus? I've never had that spelling word in high school. But now you do. You come to church to learn about phalluses. So if you guys go to Washington, and my kids went to Washington, D.C., and they don't realize it's laid out in a pentagram. They don't realize that the Washington Monument is a giant phallus. They don't realize that. But if you study Freemasonry, you'll totally understand where that came from. You'll totally see, because Washington, D.C. is laid out in the prescription of a total Freemasonry way. Symbols are all over there, no doubt about it, along with the Christian symbols. So it's very confusing for people, because they're like, what's going on here? I see Christian symbols all over the place, but then I see Masonic symbols, which are Luciferian symbols all over the place, and they can't compute it because they don't understand some of the founding fathers were active Freemasons. Whatever they knew about it, maybe they were in the Blue Lodge and didn't go very far, but if they went to the higher levels, that's pretty serious stuff right there. Freemasonry, by the way, is Luciferian. It is definitely occultic. It is off-the-chart cult stuff, okay? Now, you'll see guys in Bakersfield, like at the Potato Bowl, wearing the Shriner's hat. Those guys with the Shriner's hat, they may do good things, and their motto is to make good men better, which is total paganry, by the way, because you can't make... There is no such thing as a good man, because Jesus was asked, who is a good man? He said, why do you call me good? You're just assuming men are good? Because they're not. They're evil. They have a sin nature. And so you see the Potato Bowl, the Shriners, you know, they get wheelchairs for kids and all that stuff. And it's all good stuff. It's philanthropy. And nothing wrong with that. But what's at the core of the philanthropy is a demonic Luciferian theology behind it. So when you see those guys with a fez hat, why are they wearing a fez hat with a Moorish sword? What is that? Have anyone ever asked them? Do they even know? That comes right out of Morocco. A fez hat with a Moroccan sword? That's a Muslim sword. Why is it red? Because of the blood that they shed in Morocco and killing people. It's all satanic. It's all it's Muslim. It's a Muslim influence on the fez hat. It's red. Has a curved sword, and that's total. That comes from the Middle East. So why are the Shriners wearing a Middle Eastern hat that's blood red? Well, if you look at the massacre that happened in Morocco, what happened there, it's taken from that idea. And then look, I mean, I hate to tell you this, man, but it is what it is. There's 33 levels in the Scottish Rite, and the York Rite has different levels. But like most of your guys, it's like the Order of the Water Buffaloes for like Fred Flintstone type of thing. You know what I mean? The first three levels, like those guys don't know anything, man. They're just thinking it's the Moose Lodge, Fred Flintstone. But it's when you pass the first three levels, then you start going up to the next levels. Dude, these guys are making like blood oaths, and they'll make the signs that the Mormons make that if I reveal the secrets of what I'm doing here at the Shriners. And by the way, they're doing it with their shirts off and they're blindfolded and someone's sticking a sword to their chest, and it's just really weird stuff. And they swear that if they reveal the secrets of the Masonic Lodge, then they should be cursed with their entrails coming out and their neck being cut off. So they'll do this with the movement of this. So the Mormons do that as well. When I think they're married in the temple, I believe it. Ed Decker revealed that. But at the certain levels, a Freemason will renounce Christ for the great architect of the universe that they call in the Luciferian, which is nothing but Lucifer. So when you see those Shriner guys, that's a 33-degree Mason with the little hats. That dude has sold out to Lucifer. Okay, because at least the 15th level, that's where they renounce all their former religions to the great architect of the universe. So that's pretty serious. It's very Luciferian. Now, Southern Baptists tried to get rid of them. They had so many deacons and even pastors that were involved in the Freemasons, and this was probably in the late 80s or early 90s. They tried to get rid of them, maybe even earlier than that, and tried to get rid of them, but they couldn't, actually. There were so many, and they were dug in like a tick on a hound. They couldn't get them out. So the Southern Baptists kind of left them there. And so in the South, it's very, very concentrated over there in Southern Baptist life. And it's just weird. And they'll wear their rings and stuff like that. And if they come up with another Shriner and they need help, they need a job, they take care of one another like that. It's really weird. It's a weird, weird thing. Don't ever join that. That's like very Luciferian. Anyway, that's the thing about the obelisk. So all of a sudden, you start looking at the church, early church, in Pergamos, and you're starting to see, what in the world is this? Who brought that in? What's going on? So anyway, I'll show you a little bit more in just a bit, but let's go through this. And he goes, "And you hold fast to my name and did not deny my faith, even in the days which Antipas..." So he's commending them for a few things, that they held fast to his name, did not deny his name, even though this other stuff is going on. They're still, claiming to be Christian, claiming the deity of the Messiah, claiming the Trinity, all that stuff, okay? They're doing that. "And did not deny the faith," okay, "even in days which Antipas..." Antipas, it's interesting, his name is Antipas, but Antipas means against all. So his name, whoever named him, says, "I'm going to call him Antipas," against all. And interesting enough that he stood against what was happening in the church at the time with this marrying with the state and the paganism. And he goes, "Was my faithful martyr who was killed among you where Satan dwells." So one of the clues in overcoming the church of Pergamos is you've got to be like this guy, Antipas. And Antipas, believe it or not, if I have there it is. It's the best rendition I could get. So a much crueler martyrdom than probably even Polycarp had was what Antipas went through. What they did with Antipas is they actually put him in a metal bowl or something like that, and put it, the bowl was over a fire, and they scorched him to death in the metal bowl. So they heated up the metal bowl with the fire, and that's how he died. It's actually like one of the worst deaths in church history, man, to die like that. You know, they burned, I think they burned Polycarp, and they tried to boil John in hot oil, but he didn't burn because I guess God was protecting him, obviously. But Antipas went into that kind of contraption where they killed him. So that's what Jesus is referring to that stood against what was happening. He refused to compromise. And really what it was is he saw the state coming into the church and bringing its junk in and having the church promote its junk. Okay, have we seen that? Yeah, we have. And he stood against it, but it got him killed for it. They killed him for that. So he was resisting this coming into the church, this Babylonian influence. And again, why is the Babylonian influence coming in? Because Constantine has now wed the church to the state. And so what he's trying to do, Constantine, is he's using Christianity to be the glue of the empire that keeps everyone together. But Constantine is finding ways subtly to slip in Roman paganism into the church. And he does it very well, by the way. But he says, I have a few things against you because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. So therein lies another issue that you have to understand in Pergamum that has to be overcome, that has now entered into the church. Well, he says, look, you have those who hold to the doctrine of Balaam. Okay, the doctrine of Balaam. And you remember, Balaam was the prophet for hire in the Old Testament that tried to curse Israel. Remember that? And God wouldn't let him curse Israel. Tried to curse him four times. And then what Balaam figured out is, well, if I can't get God to curse them, and if I can't curse them, then what I'll do is I'll get God to judge them by causing their men to intermarry with the Moabites, and the Moabite women will lead them astray to worship a foreign god, and then they will be judged by God because of worshiping a foreign god. And by the way, it worked. That's exactly what he did. And the Israeli men fell for it, and they stumbled and married the Moabites, and then they were judged severely and killed. So he says that's what's going on there. You have people in the church that are doing this. So, okay, so there's three aspects to Balaam that you'll see in Scripture, and we have to parse this out a little bit to understand it. First, there's the way of Balaam, then there's the error of Balaam, and then there's the doctrine of Balaam. So there's three aspects associated to this prophet. Now, Balaam was a real prophet. He wasn't an Israeli prophet. He was a prophet outside of Israel. He didn't make accurate predictions, by the way. God did use him. But what he started doing, which is called the way of Balaam, 2 Peter notes him, is that he became a prophet for hire. Okay? So he started selling his religious activities to people. And so Peter will reference him, that way of Balaam, with false teachers who get into religion for, he calls in the old King James word, filthy lucre, or, you know, money. That people are getting involved in religion because there's a lot of money to be made, and they're covetous, and that's why they're doing it. So, you know, when someone asks me, why would anybody, Brandon, you know, go to seminary, spend all that time doing that, spend their time in a church or whatever, and go through all these rigorous steps to get a position, and they're like, that seems like a waste of time, but they don't realize. I go, wait a second, you don't understand. There is big money in religion. I mean, millions of dollars in religion, and because of people's, you know, an education of the Bible, that's why these false teachers flourish and they can make a lot of money. I mean, you some of these guys, Benny Hinn, Kenneth Copeland, Creflo Dollar, Joel Olstein, you realize they're like multi-millionaires, right? They live in estates, they fly $65 million jets, I mean, you've heard of the abuses, right? I mean, but that's why they do it. There's big money, and people are gullible enough. And so the way of Balaam is selling religion to people, right? That's what they do. The error of Balaam is a little bit different. The error of Balaam is Balaam thinking that he can curse the children of Israel, okay? And what it really comes down to is Balaam doesn't understand unilateral covenants. And so he tries to curse Israel four times, and out of the four times, God changes his words to bless Israel, right? And what Balaam doesn't understand is unilateral covenants. Well, what do you mean? Well, in unilateral covenants, the person that's in covenant with God, it doesn't matter how they behave. If they're in covenant with God, God is still going to keep his promises to them and won't curse them. Now, he can discipline them, which is different, but he won't curse them. So, for instance, you and I are in a unilateral covenant called the New Covenant. We're children of God if you're born again, right? So we can be disciplined by God, but we can never be cursed of God. He's never going to curse a child of his, and being cursed would be, you know, sent to hell type of thing. And so the error of Balaam from the outside world doesn't realize that once you're a child of God, you cannot be cursed. And so he was trying to curse Israel, and he never could, and that's why he gave up on that. Well, again, you have to know covenantal language. You have to know unilateral covenants to understand that. But the outside world doesn't understand that. So anyway, that's the error of Balaam. The doctrine of Balaam is what you're seeing here. So let me unpack this a little bit. Pergamum, like I said, to be thoroughly married. So what's going on in the church historically is happening to the individual believer. And here's what it is. The church is marrying into the pagan world, okay, in order to avoid something, okay? So if you follow the chronology of the churches, what church has happened before this is the church of Smyrna, which is the persecuted church and who goes through 10 persecutions, Roman persecutions, all the way up to 313 AD, okay? So when Constantine comes in, the church is all pumped out of their mind because if they marry with the state, then guess what will stop? The persecutions. So it's a compromise on the church's behalf to prevent further conflicts with the world by marrying with the state. Okay? So let's bring it to an individual level and what I mean by that. It would mean a believer would just try to get along with this world in order to avoid people thinking they're hate mongers, Islamophobic, homophobic, transphobic. They compromise with the world so they don't have conflict. Does that kind of make sense? They become worldly to avoid conflict. So if the world says, you know, transgenderism okay, they're going to say, yeah, okay, I'll do that to avoid conflict. They don't want to fight, right? That's the mentality. So they go along to get along is the mentality on an individual level to avoid conflict. Okay, I think we can all understand that on a personal level, as you can see other Christians who do that. They completely compromise in order to avoid a fight. Well, you know, my adult children are acting really, really bad. And so if, you know, they're doing unchristian things. And so if I come against them because of my Christianity, it's going to start a conflict with them, right? So they avoid it. They don't deal with it because I don't want the broken relationship. They want to avoid the conflict is the idea, right? And that's, you know, with at work, that's with society. Boy, I really don't want to say anything here, even though I should, but this whole thing where they're mutilating children because the 11-year-old thinks he's a boy or a girl, and so they're chopping body parts, but I really don't want to say anything because, you know, I don't want to fight. It's that kind of stuff, okay? So what ends up happening is the church in a typology stopped becoming a traveler in this world. The church stopped becoming a pilgrim. The church stopped its tent living as Abraham lived in a tent. Remember, the whole concept of a tent dweller is you live in a tent in this life because this is not your permanent home. You're a pilgrim just coming through. This world does not belong to you. It belongs to Satan. You belong to the next world. So therefore, you're not supposed to set roots into this world, right? That's that whole concept. It's the difference between Lot and Abraham, right? Lot goes into Sodom and Gomorrah because he likes the world. He likes what it offers. And Abraham stays out and dwells in the tents because he's going to keep the pilgrim mindset. So at this point, the church chooses Lot instead of Abraham. It goes right in to the Sodom and Gomorrah Babylonian system, so to speak, to avoid conflict. And it becomes permanent on the ground, so to speak. It starts building its permanent foundations on this world. Okay? And I could say a lot more to that because the fear in the mindset is what starts gradually happening is when you become a world dweller instead of a tent dweller, you start seeing it affect in your architecture. You start watching cathedrals being built. And the cathedral model is based on the Greek and Roman model of their places of worship. Okay? So, and all of a sudden, the church goes from house churches and dilapidated types of places where they meet and gather to all of a sudden Constantine building them Greco-Roman style cathedrals. And they become very ornate. And dude, if that is not simply putting your roots down, I don't know what is. And then at that point, all kinds of paganism comes into the cathedrals. All kinds of stuff. The steeple comes in, which is a pagan symbol of man reaching up to God. A steeple is a pagan symbol. And there's steeples all over the churches. The church should never have a steeple, ever. In fact, the Mormons have steeples, don't they? Steeple is a pagan symbol pointing up to God, the man reaching up to God. Not God reaching down to man, but man reaching up to God. So paganism comes all through this, man. Really bad. So I'll get to that in just a bit. But let's then go to how the sex is involved and how that leads to the idolatry and the pagan practices. Because if you go back, Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols, so basically idolatry, that's what you would be doing by eating things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality. So notice the idolatry and the sexual immorality are connected together. Okay, there's always a reason for that. Every time you see this in the Bible, wherever idolatry is, sexual immorality is. Wherever sexual immorality is, idolatry will be there. The two go hand in hand, always together. Okay, I'll explain it in just a bit. So Balaam, in order to entice Israel, is going to use the Moabite women to seduce them and in fact marry them and commit fornication or whatever, or even according to Mosaic law, marry outside the Jewish context into paganism. So the core issue is to use sex as a tool to entice the worship of a foreign deity. That's what Balaam's doing. And quite frankly, that's as old as Balaam himself. That's very ancient. Sex becomes a weaponized tool in the hands of an individual who knows how to actually use it against people. And when you use it, you can get them to worship a foreign god. Well, how is that? I don't understand. Well, follow me. Probably the easiest thing to seduce somebody is through sex. That's primarily the primary thing. And it's the most ancient of the temptations, okay? So God is the one who puts the restrictions on it, but Satan is the one who unleashes all Hades on it, right? And when you unleash all Hades on it without the bounds of marriage, it does go crazy. It goes wild and it destroys things pretty bad. Okay, so why use sex? Well, yeah, there's diseases and all that stuff, but why is sex associated to idolatry? What's the connection there? Well, I want you to think about something about sex. It's not about the sex. That's the tool, that's the mechanism, but it's not about the sex. In order to get somebody to move from one God to another in a paganistic fashion, or to move off of the worship of Yahweh, or to move off the worship of Jesus and worship another foreign God, even though they won't say they're doing it, but they are, the best tool to use is the person giving the sex. That's who you would use if you were Satan. So you got to think like Satan would do. Because why? Well, it's not about the sex. It's about the relationship. That's what it's about. So sex becomes a substitute for a relationship that they really don't have, but they think they have. So sex becomes a counterfeit to a relationship. Sex becomes a counterfeit to a bond. Sex becomes a counterfeit to an emotional bond. Sex becomes a counterfeit to a spiritual bond. Sex becomes a counterfeit to a mental bond. And like I said, you have to have the first three before you bond physically. So what happens to people is they bond sexually and they think they have a relationship because of sex, because it's really the consummation of the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual connection that's supposed to be happening here, but they've put the cart before the horse. And then, but the problem is they think they're in relationship with a person and they're really not. Okay, so Satan knows this. And humans should know this. So this is why we try to tell our teens, hey man, don't have premarital sex. And they don't understand what we're trying to say. It's because you will be faked out that think you have a real relationship, and then you will get bonded to the individual, and you will think you're really bonded when you're really not, and then that leads you astray. Okay, how does it lead you astray? Because if I think I'm bonded to somebody, and I think I'm in a relationship with somebody, I will let my guard down. Theologically. So Satan already knows, if I'm going to break you down theologically, I'm not going to sit there and batter you with a Jehovah's Witness at your door, or batter you with a Mormon coming to your door, or batter you with some Catholic priest coming to your door. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give the opposite sex to you, and that opposite sex is connected to paganism, occultism, a false religion, a false this, a false that, and then you will be wooed by the relationship because you think you have a relationship when you really don't. And then that relationship will break your barriers down. You will let your guard down. And when she says, hey, Tom Brady, let's sacrifice to my witch idol so that you can win the Super Bowl, what do you think Tom Brady does? I'm talking about a real story. His ex-wife was a real witch. And she made him do sacrifices to these pagan things to her altar so he would win the Super Bowl and stuff like that, right? So she broke down Tom Brady to become a practicing witch because of the relationship with her. Oh, that's how it works? Yeah, that's how it works. That's how it works at every level. That's how it works at dating. That's how it works on every relationship. That's how it works in the marriage, because then people figure out that they can manipulate the other person through sex, through a fake relationship that they really don't have, even though they're married. They can manipulate through sex, and people are stupid enough to be manipulated by it, and they don't even realize they're being manipulated by it, and then the person can get them to do anything they want them to do, basically. Believe anything you want them to believe. Read anything they want them to read. Watch whatever they want them to watch. It doesn't matter. I can break you down through relationship. Okay, so what does that say? It tells you that if you're going to play the game of overcoming Pergamum, you better have your relationship issue figured out. Because if you don't, you'll hook up with the wrong person, and the wrong person will take you into idolatry, take you into paganism. You'll be worshiping a foreign God and not even know it because you want the sex so bad or the relationship so bad. That's how people get broken down. And it's like that time over again. There is no other trick that Satan has. That's the trick. That's how he does it. And people don't listen. People don't think that he's going to do it. Oh, I'm strong. No, you can't. I'm sorry. You can't. You can't. You're not strong enough. No one is. It's the only sin you're told to flee from. The Bible never says stay and stand against sexual immorality. It says get out of dodge. Move. Get out of there. You know why? Because you can't handle it. Most people can't handle it because they are relational deprived. They are nurtured deprived. They have a fundamental problem inside of them, and they're desperate for a relationship. They're lonely. They just want someone to love them, and that sets them up to be a target for false theology. That's what it happens. So they get hooked up with somebody. The guy says he's a Christian, or the girl says she's a Christian, and then they think, well, I've met the criteria. I'm like, oh man, that is not the only criteria. That cannot be the only criteria, for goodness sakes. If that's your only criteria, I mean, you're going to end up marrying crazy people, right? There's plenty of crazy Christians out there. They're nuts. Psychopathic, sociopathic. I'm Christian. I have no guilt for anything I do, though. Marry me. I'm on eHarmony, please. Dude, and people, well, Brandon, they're a Christian. I know we can make it work. So then what happens? So like, I'll even tell Christians, well, you're not even looking for someone just a Christian. I'm looking for someone like more mature than me. I'm not going to be pulling someone along. Who wants to do that? How many women are pulling their husbands along? Come on, dude. Act more spiritual, dude. How many women have to suffer through that nonsense because they're dragging their husbands along? You know, and it's whatever. And vice versa. But then what starts happening then is even in the marriage, the sex becomes the controller and the manipulated. It's all centered around that, and it's centered around a fake counterfeit relationship that's really not happening. So people mistake having sex as having a relationship. It's part of the relationship, but it's the end result of the relationship. It's the end result. It's not the beginning. So anyway, when you take this apart, you totally understand that what Balaam did to Israel was very sophisticated and very smart, satanically. Satanically smart. Because somehow Balaam knew that whole scheme and how that would work. And it worked brilliantly, by the way. And oh, by the way, it works brilliantly now. It works really good. Okay, so before I go any further, any questions on that? That's the doctrine of Balaam. Okay, that has to be overcome in your life. Well, what do you mean? Well, first of all, you can never substitute sex for relationship. Okay, that's the first thing. The minute you do that, you are vulnerable to false doctrine. That's how you go from sexual immorality to idolatry. That's how you go. It's the person you're having sex with that gets you into the idolatry. Because think about this. If someone is going to go outside the confines of the parameters, what kind of person am I really dealing with if they wanted to marry me? What kind of person am I dealing with? Because if they're willing to go to the physical first before all the other stuff, then what do you think they'll do in the marriage? And where do you think they're going to take me else? Because look, they're already telling you, I don't abide by doctrine. I don't abide by doctrine. So like people will tell me, they go on these dating sites and everyone says they're a Christian and they come back to me and say, Brandon, I go out with a guy one time on these dating sites and all they want to do is have sex. Okay, so what's the theology telling you? The theology is telling you he doesn't care of the prohibitions against it. So if I marry him, I already know the theology of the individual. He's willing to break God's law now. He'll break it later. And he'll probably break it in other ways that are bigger. Oh, yeah. And so when people tell me I didn't know what I was marrying, oh, yeah, you did. You did. You just ignored it. We have a confirmation bias and all this other stuff that goes on, and we don't look at the emotions that take over. We don't look at the red flags. And there's red flags all over the place, and they get ignored. And what ends up happening is the person becomes worse spiritually at the end of it. That's what ends up happening. Their marriage actually takes them down spiritually. So it's a very common problem. So here's the thing. You can see this is more widespread than not, that a Christian has to overcome even their marriage relationship that's taking them down spiritually. That's really at the core of this, that their marriage is not bringing them down spiritually because they married the wrong person or whatever, right? And the person's an idolater. Says they're a Christian, but they're idolaters. You know, you can be an idolater and a Christian. Worship money, worship other things, worship themselves, narcissist, whatever. But it's taking them down spiritually. So they have to overcome that. Well, how are they going to overcome that? Because they're married. But you can't get rid of the relationship. Yeah, right. I know. You can't get rid of the relationship. But you're married to an idolater, someone that has no theological concepts. So what are you going to do? You can't join them in the idolatry. You can't let them break your theological barriers down because you're married to them. And that's what happens to couples. Their relationship barriers just drop because they're married to somebody. Well, that's where you're going to get caught up theologically. And so Messiah is saying, look, you've got to love me before even your spouse. You've got to obey me more than your spouse. You can't obey your spouse. You've got to obey me. Your spouse is turning into an idol because he or she is dangling the relationship aspect over your head through sex, and you're succumbing to that and dropping your theology for that. So that has to be overcome. So it's more interpersonal than you actually imagine with this church. Anyway, what starts happening? Church edifice becomes a temple all of a sudden. House of God, the name transfers to a building instead of a congregation of people gathered together. Then what happens is creation of sacred spaces, which is very Greco-Roman in the temples, of sacred spaces. So the church becomes a sacred space, okay? They start burning incense like they do in Roman Greco temples. They used a basilica model, which was designed after the pagan temples. You guys all know about a basilica. The candles and burning incense are introduced as priests entered the basilica. Steeple, again, represents paganism trying to reach up to the heavens. Then special and formal clothing required to come to church to honor God, basically called suiting up. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, it's pagan. The early church was come as you are, not suit up. You went to a pagan temple by suiting up and wearing your garb. Priestly class starts developing. Special clothing, white clothing for them. The clothing separates them from the average person. They start lording it over. The priests start becoming sacred. All of a sudden, various gestures of respect given to clergy, as if they're and the gestures of respect were given as if they were a Roman official. As if you were saluting a dignitary in the Roman government. So this crossover is starting to happen and being given to the priests. Like I said, Pontifex Maximus, master of ceremonies, grand master of the lodge, now they were the custodians of the mysteries of God. Look, I already told you what the mysteries of God are. There's nine of them. They're all spelled out in the New Testament. What is a mystery? Something that wasn't spoken of in the Old Testament. Now it's revealed in the New Testament. And there's nine of them. Seven good ones, two bad. I'll give an example. The church is a mystery. The body of Christ is a mystery. The rapture is a mystery, right? The satanic mystery that the mystery of lawlessness is now at work. The other satanic mystery is that the whore will ride the dragon, or the beast, I should say. That's another mystery that got revealed. That's a negative mystery. So all the mysteries that God wants us to know have been revealed. So what in the world is the Catholic Church, what mysteries are they referring to? I don't know. Because only whatever you're hiding from us would only come from Babylon, because it's not coming from Scripture, because God has already revealed the mysteries he wanted us to know. Anyway, the priests are become mediators between God and man all of a sudden. Lord's Supper turns into a sacrifice. Fear and dread is associated. Only people who are holy can handle it. Seen as an offering of sacrifice, Mass is introduced in 394 AD, becomes a priestly ritual. Sacred altar now is in the church. Altar, an altar. What are you talking about, an altar? There's no such thing as having an altar in a church. Where do you put an altar at? Where would an altar be? What is it for? An altar is for sacrifice. So why am I putting an altar in a church? The sacrifice has already been made. What am I bringing an altar for? Oh, because I'm going to reintroduce re-sacrificing the Messiah again and again and again and again and again. Every Mass, I'm going to re-sacrifice the Messiah. But Hebrews says he only was sacrificed once and for all. Sacred altar now in the church. Okay, no longer connected to a love feast, a communal feast. Now it's a ritual. By 4th century, transubstantiation is established. What I mean by that is instead of do this in memory of me, the priest turned this into transubstantiation, that it actually turns into the body and blood of Jesus. So the wine is the actual blood and the bread is the actual body. And then, so like today, if you go to a Catholic church, they're genuflecting, especially when the altar light is on. The candle altar is on, that means the host is in there, which means that there's elements of the bread and wine that have been consecrated to be the actual body and blood of the Messiah, and that's why the candle's lit in the background, and you're to genuflect as you come in. You will genuflect because that's actually Christ there. That is the highest level of idolatry you could ever imagine. That's purely idolatry. So when a Catholic tells me, I don't bow down to statues, yeah, you do. You genuflect every time you walk in there because of the host, which you say is Christ, which that's wrong theologically. Christ has a human body, and that body is located in heaven. If his body is here and over here and over here and over here, you guys all know that's a bleed of a deity into the humanity of Christ, and you have to keep the two separate. You can't blend the two natures. You have the deity and the humanity. The humanity can't be everywhere. It's a human body. It's locatable in only one place. So you have huge theological problems with transubstantiation. And so it's idolatry, flat out idolatry. Baptism becomes efficacious. You're baptized into the church without regard of anyone's faith, and you become a member of the state at that point in time. So if you want to be a member of California, so to speak, if that was where you live, you'd have to be baptized to be a member of not only the church, but of the state as well. So you had all kinds of unbelievers being baptized, considered to be Christians. And then what do you do when you bring a bunch of unbelievers into a church and all you did was put water on them and they're really not converted? Well, you have just a pagan church. It just goes crazy, man, at that point in time. So you're a member of the church and a member of the Roman society? Yeah. That's how you got your membership, basically. So idolatry just went nuts. So what did Constantine do? Well, you have all these pagans coming in. They like worshiping statues. You know what? We got that in Christianity. We'll just make saints out of them. We'll just say, hey, venerate the saints. That'll be the substitute from the pagan gods, so you'll worship the saints. That's what happened. Female deity starts worshiping, obviously with Mary, because pagans worship female deities. They start calling her Queen of Heaven. It carries on to today. They start delaying baptism up to 3 years. Because here's the thing about baptism. If you know enough to be saved, then you know enough to be baptized. That's how it works. You don't need a 3-year catechism to be baptized. It's if you know enough to be saved, you know enough to be baptized. Anyway, baptism starts to get associated with the forgiveness of sins, so people delayed it until they died, actually. So they would go live like crazy and then hope that they could be on their deathbed and get baptized at the end and all their sins be forgiven. I mean, it was just total game, total misinterpretation of Christianity. So they start baptizing infants at this time and they start dunking them because, you know, the concept of, well, they have original sin and if this baby dies, they'll go in limbo, which I don't know where they got. They totally made that up. And so mamas didn't want their babies to go into limbo. And so they said, well, you need to baptize our babies then. Well, okay, we'll baptize them. So they start dunking them. And the mama said, we don't like them being dunked. So sprinkle them. And so the priest gave in and sprinkled them. So that's where sprinkling came from. But it came from the wrong theological thought that, well, if we don't baptize this child and the child dies, which you would have high infant mortality at this time, obviously, they go to limbo? Well, what are you talking about? Where did you get that at? So it was just made up. Your stuff just made up like that, right? And so the whole thing of pedo baptism or infant baptism came from that concept, and then it led to sprinkling. And today we have denominations that sprinkle, and a lot of them don't even know that the roots go all the way back to the moms getting mad about their babies being dunked. So when you study church history, you start realizing, what in the world are we doing anymore? What is this? Why? What's the tradition behind this? And it's like totally pagan, totally stupid. So you have entire denominations, guys, that sprinkle. You realize that. Entire denominations. And the word itself, baptism, means to immerse into water. That the word itself means that. Yeah, we're going to do sprinkling. Okay, whatever, man. So when other things start happening, reverencing and praying for the dead starts. Prayers to the saints start about 300. They start honoring the dead through meals and feasts at the cemetery. I call them graveyard picnics. By the way, they do them in Bakersfield too, by the way. It's nuts. I don't understand the graveyard picnic stuff. I don't get it. But anyway, they do so like you see in Mexico, they do the Day of the Dead type of stuff. It's not that they invented that. This goes all the way back to paganism, right? That's just pagan. Pagans do this stuff, rituals at the graves and whatnot. Anyway, they start experiencing worshiping in the company of the saints by being in these cemeteries. So the cemeteries start becoming holy places that they start hanging out with. And this is the concept of where goth comes from. You know, we see someone dressed in all in black. Well, gothic is that mentality. We're going to worship in cemeteries. They're sacred places and they're holy places because that's where the saints are. It's just weird stuff. So you start having monuments and shrines built for special martyrs all in these places, yada, yada. And then people start making pilgrimages to these places and venerating the bones of saints, all that junk, right? So you have the whole relic issue in Catholicism, right? Objects become sacred. Weird stuff. Pagan mythology starts. Sign of the cross. You seen that? Yeah, that's pagan. Eastern mysticism develops. So again, Eastern mysticism comes from like Hinduism and Buddhism. That infiltrates the Desert Fathers through asceticism. Art pictures of Jesus, other saints put into churches. Now, it's not so bad to have an art or a picture of that. It's what they did with them. They worshiped them. So these people they put up a picture of Jesus and they're worshiping it. It's not wrong to have a picture of Jesus, but you don't worship it. You know that's not Jesus, right? It's a picture of him or some type of rendition, but they were worshiping it, man. I grew up Catholic. I saw what they did. They're worshiping the things. Flat out idolatry. Then we have magic is introduced into the turning of the bread into water and wine. And it comes from Constantine. It was very superstitious, very pagan mindset. So for instance, what do you mean like magic? Well, if you ever watch a Catholic mass, they on the altar, they'll change the bread and the wine into the actual body and blood, not really, but magically speaking. Does that make sense? Okay, so they'll say a Latin prayer over that, and then by doing that, that reconstitutes the bread and the wine into the actual body and blood. And so that's very magic. And in fact, the Latin words that they use is where we get the word abracadabra. So, like, if you listen to a Latin mass, he'll say something akin to that, but it's Latin, right? And so people picked up on that, and they said, well, he's doing the magic, and they would hear something to the effect of abracadabra. He's not saying abracadabra, but he's saying something different that sounds like that if you would be sitting in the pew. And so people picked up on that magic and started using the word as in magic, abracadabra. But it's actually the Latin. And then holding back the mysteries. And so the only way you can get the mysteries revealed to you is through the priests. And I don't know what these mysteries are, but apparently they know them and they won't reveal them. So whatever. It's weird. Choir then was brought in after the Edict of Milan, 313 AD, copied from the Roman imperial ceremonies that had professional music to help celebrate the Eucharist. I want you to notice this. The roots of the choir came from the Greek and Roman dramas. The choirs were put in special clothing. Singing was done by a special group, not by the people. By 367 AD, congregational singing is banned, and young choir boys are established from the Greco-Roman influence. The mass becomes a spectacle for entertainment. They did do one thing that was good. If you have noticed in a Catholic church, they still have them today, and I don't know if they have them in Lutheran churches, but the choir is always in the back. It's never in the front. That is the one thing they did that was good. Because today, as you know, music has turned into worshiptainment in most churches. And even back then, they knew if you put them up in front, they're going to take all the attention. And so even the Catholic Church was even smart enough, we're putting them in the back. Now, they did a bunch of bad stuff, but I'll at least commend them for that, right? They put them in the back. And look, man, there's an old saying in ministry, when Satan fell, he fell in the choir loft. Yeah, he did. I will verify that. If you want wars, it's always with music. It's hands down, man. And so, but anyway, this started developing. So again, like I said, members of the state and the members of the church, so this is how Babylon got introduced. The tithe then is introduced in the 4th century by arguing from the Levitical system of the Old Testament. Apparently enough people don't know the Bible well enough to know the Old Testament system has been rendered inoperative. And so they employed that into the tithing in medieval Europe. Basically, they became landlords. They used about 10% Levitical law for taxing people to rent their land. And so it was a fusion of medieval rent law combined with Old Testament practice that where you get the 10% tithe. Comes from the 8th century. It's pretty shocking when you see this, because my thing is, I took church history when I went to school, but then you get into real practice and you're like, you see this pastor guy up there saying, you got to give 10%. I'm like, dude, did you not study church history? Did you not know where this came from? Medieval feudal landlord situations? What are you talking about? And you're telling people 10%? You're crazy. You apparently have not learned church history. I think church history, to me, it might be the most boring subject when you're studying it, but when you're able to connect dots of like where stuff comes from, that's when it takes on a life of its own. And you're like, well, that came from, you know, moms wanting their babies sprinkled instead of dung. Or that came from, rent from landlords. By the way, the 10% became the practice of all European churches and carried over into the United States. Still used today, unfortunately, as legalism. Look at this. Look at the timeline. Prayers for the dead. Making of the sign of the cross. Worship of saints and angels, 394. Mass is first celebrated. Worship of Mary, 431. 500. Priests began dressing differently. 526. Extreme use of rubbing or sprinkling oil during religious ceremonies. 593, Doctrine of Purgatory was introduced. 600, a mass started conducted in Latin. 600 AD, prayer started being directed to Mary. Is that not crazy? And it just kept going on and on and on. And when you get to the church of Thyatira, boy, howdy, it's called, that era is called the pornocracy. That's how bad it got in church history. It got that bad. And then obviously the Reformation came out of that because Luther, not that I'm a big fan of Luther, but he went into the Vatican and saw what they were doing. He's like, oh my gosh. He goes, the priests are having prostitutes. And it was the pornocracy. It had totally been adulterated. So bad. So bad. So anyway, this is Pergamum. This is when it all starts. This is where it all came from. You have to overcome this, okay? And I have yet to get to the reward, but what I'm showing you is this must be overcome. If you said, I have overcome that, good for you. You're on the right path then.
Thanks for joining us for another lesson. We hope that this message is a blessing for you and helps you grow towards a more mature understanding of God's Word. For more information about our ministry, we invite you to check out our website at rockharborchurch.net. Until next time, remember, keep looking up, for our redemption draws near.